Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey there, everybody. Welcome to Rough Draft. I'm your host, Reza Aslan. Our guest on the pod today is novelist and essayist Viet Thanh Nguyen. He is the author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel, The Sympathizer, and its sequel, The Committed. He's also the author of a New York Times best-selling collection of short stories called The Refugees. And let me tell you something, writers. If you manage to write a short story collection and even that becomes a bestseller, you're probably doing something right. He's also the author of a collection of nonfiction essays called Nothing Ever Dies, a book that deals with memory and war and what it means to be a refugee, which is what Viet was. In fact, those themes are intertwined into a lot of his writings, fiction and nonfiction. Viet himself came to the United States as a refugee in 1975 with his family from Vietnam. And one of the things that we talk about a lot in our conversation with him is about how that experience kind of informed the way that he writes these characters. In fact, there's this moment in one of the short stories, the one that launches Viet's collection, The Refugees, in which the protagonist, who's this professional ghostwriter, and by the way, herself also a refugee from war-torn Vietnam, talks about her family's arrival in the U.S., and what she says is this, quote, "In a country where possessions counted for everything, we had no belongings except our stories." It's really interesting because the line is obviously spoken from a place of desperation, right? It's a line that indicates scarcity and want, pain and suffering. But if you talk to Viet about it, what he'll tell you is that stories are in fact our most prized possessions, right? Stories define who we are. They're how we make sense of the world and our place in it. Our stories link us to the past. They're the tendons that connect us to those who came before us and those who are still to come. I mean, if you look at human evolution, storytelling is how we understood who we were in the world. It's how we created our culture and our communities and our religions. Our very sense of self was discovered through storytelling. And so the person who preserves those stories, right? The person who carries stories from place to place, country to country, that person is not an immigrant or a refugee. That person is not just a writer. That person becomes a kind of historian, a kind of prophet. And that's precisely how I see Viet as a writer. He is not just a successful award-winning novelist. And when I say award-winning, this son of a bitch has won basically every award you can imagine. The Pulitzer, he's got a Guggenheim, he's got a MacArthur Genius Grant. He is a goddamn certified genius, right? But for him, he thinks of himself first and foremost as a storyteller. And there's something I think valuable to be learned in that idea for all of us. Because one of the things I always tell my students, particularly my young students who are thinking about maybe becoming writers, is that writing isn't an art. It's a craft. It's a thing that can be learned. It's a thing that you have to practice and rehearse. And you really do have to think of it as a job. In fact, the thing that I probably say most often to my students is, if you don't treat writing like a job, it will never be your job, right? So many writers think that, oh, writing is about letting the muses come to you and inspire the beauty and the art to flow out of you. No, writing is sitting down and typing and typing and typing. It's a grind. You know, no, the guy who works the fries at McDonald's doesn't say to himself, you know, in the mornings, does the spirit move me to make fries today? No, it's his job. He punches the clock, he does it. Same thing about being a writer. And I don't know whether it's because I'm an immigrant and Viet's an immigrant and, you know, immigrants, let's face it, like we work very hard. You know, we know how tenuous our hold on the things that we have can be. So we work extra hard. But it's a lesson that Viet really comes to again and again and again. He had to watch his parents basically work 14 hours a day in a grocery store. So he understands what work means, and he brings that commitment to work to his writing. It's a very important lesson for us to learn. Along with Viet, we have a special musical guest on this episode of Rough Draft, Thao Nguyen, also from Vietnam, though she was born here in the United States. She is a singer and songwriter and the frontman for the amazing band Thao and the Get Down, Stay Down. She performs a song solo for us at the end of the show. You're not going to want to miss that. So, without further ado, I present to you our conversation with novelist, Pulitzer Prize winning novelist, I should say, and MacArthur genius. Hey, MacArthur people, I'm smart too. I mean, call me. That's all I'm saying is call me. Anyway, here, without further ado, our conversation with Pulitzer Prize winning novelist, Viet Thanh Nguyen. First of all, congratulations on your huge success.
Thank you so much. Your debut novel,
New York Times bestseller, basically won every award possible, the Pulitzer, the Carnegie Medal. They gave you the MacArthur Genius Grant. So basically, I want to start with two questions. First of all, who the fuck do you think you are?
I ask myself that every day, I mean, as a matter of fact.
What is that? Like, I mean, come on. First of all, what I want to know is, when you were like writing this book, I mean, did you have an idea of like what the response was going to be? I mean, did you know, is what I mean to say.
No, I had no clue. You know, as a matter of fact, I had a great time writing the novel, but I gave my agent the first half of the novel, and he said, oh, I really like it, but you know, the narrator is sort of unlikable. And my reaction was, well, I like him.
Yeah.
You know, and my agent was like, well, I think it's a really good literary book, but we just have no idea if it's going to sell or not. So you can't connect these two things. And I mean, I wrote the book because I really wanted to write the book. And I had just come off 11 years of writing a short story collection, which I hated every moment of doing. And partly it was because I was learning how to be a writer, but also because those short stories, I was thinking of an audience for them, of other people.
Right.
You know, editors, agents, tastemakers, that kind of thing.
The vast, vast short story reading audience
Absolutely.
Out there. Yeah.
But when you're a
Huge
short story
market.
Writer, you
Huge
care
market.
You care about
yes,
that, right?
Yes, it's true.
So, but when it came time to writing The Sympathizer, my thought was, well, fuck it. I'm going to write this book for myself. And that was a huge breakthrough for me. So your question of who the fuck do you think you are is absolutely right.
Yeah,
you
know,
because I had to just write for myself.
What was the moment after the book came out where you suddenly kind of became aware that this was going to be a thing? Do you know what I mean? Like, was there one moment where you were like, oh shit, this is going to be a thing?
I got really lucky because the first major review of the book was a front page review in the New York Times book review. Now that's a thing.
That is a thing.
For most writers, that's all they want, right?
That's,
And then of course that went on to sell hundreds of copies. So
yes.
It was not a thing in terms of like making me rich, but it was a thing in terms of fulfilling this literary ambition
right.
that most writers have.
Right.
And it was a good, you know, omen for what happened to the book.
I guess the issue here is, you know, like, it's fantastic that you have this enormous success kind of with the first shot out. But now you have to do another one, right? Like, I mean, there's a lot of anticipation for this next novel. And I imagine some pressure. I guess basically what I'm asking is, why aren't you home writing? What are you doing here?
That's a very good question. I have a hard time saying no. I mean, this is actually the most difficult
That's
challenge that I have. But I did write 1,500 words this morning on the sequel to The Sympathizer. And in fact, one of the key lines in the sequel is, who the fuck do you think you are?
No way.
No, absolutely.
So it's a legit, it's a sequel.
It's a real sequel.
Okay,
it's a real sequel.
Did I just break that news? I didn't know.
No. It's been out there, and I tell people.
Can we just say that I broke that news?
Yes, you can.
I can't believe we broke that news.
It's amazing, isn't it? I didn't set out to write a sequel. You know, I just thought I was going to write The Sympathizer and move on to do something else. But by the time I reached the end, I thought I'm actually I don't think I'm done with this character, and I don't think I'm done with the issues that the book raises. I thought I was done, but there's more to explore.
After 20 years of writing it or whatever, right?
Well, The Sympathizer took 2 years.
2 years, sorry.
2 years, yes. And this, the writing of the sequel is taking a couple of years longer than that.
You know, it's funny because you and I actually have a lot in common. we both won Pulitzers. We both came here as kids, right? We both, in the 70s, we both fled war, violence, in my case, revolution.
We both come from countries that Americans are scared of.
That's true, very true. We both settled in San Jose.
Right.
San Ho.
Right. Every time I meet a person from San Jose, I get so excited. Like, nobody comes out of San Jose.
Nobody comes out of San Jose. Yeah. Do you know the way to San Jose?
I grew up with that song.
It was like
one of the worst songs in history.
It's a shit song.
Even in the late 70s, when that song was popular, it was playing on PSAs on KNTV 11 in San Jose. This is bad.
It was always a joke song. Yeah. Nobody actually took that song seriously except for San Jose. It was like it's our pride and joy.
Not now, though.
By the way, there is a difference, though. Mm. I went to a shitty public high school, Del Mar. Go Dons. You went to a preppy Catholic school, Bellarmine.
Yes.
My real question to you is, you do know what we would say about you guys, right?
I think we had a good idea.
Yeah, you little Catholic boy assholes with your little douchey pants and your nice shoes. I mean.
But the thing is, I was not one of those guys. I was the outcast at Bellarmine. I was a refugee nerd
Bellarmine. Tell me about that. Yeah, what was that like?
Okay, so for people who don't know, Bellarmine, I think, is probably the best high school in the San Jose area.
And yeah, it literally
it literally produces the leaders of San Jose.
That's a thing.
The
that's
current mayor of San Jose was my classmate, for example.
There you go. Okay?
And so the people who are in power come from Bellarmine, right?
Yeah. And Bellarmine at the time, Catholic prep.
Yeah. And at the time that I went in the 1980s, it was mostly a white high school. And so for people like me to come, it was sort of a change for the school, but also a challenge for us. There were like three Vietnamese guys in my entire school. But now when I come back, there's like a whole Vietnamese brotherhood. So things have radically changed, because as San Jose has become more multicultural, or as, you know, the immigrants have risen in prosperity, they've infiltrated into Bellarmine because they know this is a place where power gets brokered.
Power in San Jose happens right there. So you were talking about the fact that it was a little bit difficult for you in Bellarmine as a refugee kid, Vietnamese immigrant. Talk about your childhood a little bit. Can you tell us a little bit about what kind of that experience was like, fleeing your home country, coming here? You, from what I understand, actually spent some time in a refugee camp in Pennsylvania, which there are refugee camps in Pennsylvania. Did anybody else know this, that there are refugee camps in Pennsylvania? Are they like refugees from Ohio? What was this camp? I've never heard of this.
Basically what happened is 130,000 Vietnamese people fled from communism at the fall of Saigon in 1975, and the United States took them in, sort of reluctantly, but they did, you know, they did take us in. And they had to find a place to... we went through, for example, military bases in Guam, and then we got flown to the United States, and we got put into one of four refugee camps. And these refugee camps were just basically in American military bases. So the nearest one here is Camp Pendleton.
I ended up
in the much less glamorous Fort Indiantown Gap of Pennsylvania, which no one has heard of. And in order to leave this camp, you had to have a sponsor. So, you know, no sponsor was willing to take all four of us, my parents, my brother, and me. So we got broken up.
Oh,
so my parents went to one sponsor. My 10-year-old brother went to one. 4-year-old me went to another. And when you're 4 years old, you don't have any sense of what is going on. So I remember this being a very traumatic experience, being separated from my parents.
Imagine.
It only lasted, I think, for 2 or 3 months. But to a 4-year-old, it feels
for
like forever.
That's forever.
So my 10-year-old brother didn't come home for 2 years.
Jesus.
You know. And so he tells me, that's how we know mom and dad love you more.
Right.
Because they couldn't stand being separated from that long. But don't worry. He went to Harvard. He went to Stanford. So the trauma did him good.
Just fine. Yeah.
He had something to write about in his college application essay.
Perfect personal essay, right? So then when you guys were finally brought back together as a family, is that when you ended up in San Jose?
What happened was, you know, my parents were very successful business people in Vietnam. Mm-hmm. And they were born as peasants, worked their way up, then lost a lot coming to the United States as refugees. They came as refugees, and of course, well-meaning Americans thought, well, you guys are refugees. Why don't we get you jobs working as custodians at the nursing home?
Right.
And that's not what my parents wanted to do with their lives, right? And they had their best friend moved to San Jose, and she called them up. This is the refugee network. Everybody's you know, trying to figure out where's the best place to go. And she said, hey, the weather's better. Economy's better. And so my parents, in three years after we moved to Harrisburg, moved to San Jose, and we opened the second Vietnamese grocery store, or they opened the second Vietnamese grocery store in downtown San Jose.
Beautiful, shining downtown
San Do you remember downtown San Jose?
I remember downtown San Jose. I remember how it changed because we lived there before they had invented the personal computer.
Right. So if you go to visit downtown San Jose now, it looks all nice and glossy and everything. Yeah. In the late 70s, early 80s, when my parents were there on East Santa Clara Street, nobody wanted to be there but Vietnamese refugees.
I remember
this very clearly, okay, because my parents opened this grocery store, and then I was 10 or 11 walking down Santa Clara Street, and a lot of Vietnamese businesses that have opened in the late 70s and early 80s saw a sign in a store window that said, another American driven out of business by the Vietnamese. And I didn't know the word racism.
Right.
It stuck with me, though, that sign.
You didn't know what it was called, but you knew it was just fucked up. Like, you had an idea that something is wrong about this.
I mean, you saw your parents struggling, I assume. I saw my parents struggling. Oh, yeah. And then you see the sign. Like, these people, the person who wrote the sign has no idea what the Vietnamese people have gone through, including my parents, to get to this country, and what is happening on East Santa Clara Street in downtown San Jose, where my parents got shot on Christmas Eve in their grocery store. And that's not the only thing that happened, you know, but a whole bunch of stuff. So anyway, if you go to downtown San Jose now and you see the new shiny City Hall that's built on East Santa Clara Street, it's literally across the street from my parents' store, which is no longer there. And what happened was the city forced my parents to sell their property so that they could build the new Symphony on top of my parents' store, which actually never happened. Okay, you talk about what powers being broken.
Right,
it never happened. So for years and years, all there was a parking lot there. And if you go there now, there's a hole in the ground, last time I went, because they're building a gigantic condominium complex on top of where my parents' store once stood. So this is America, right?
Yeah,
you know, refugees come, immigrants come, we struggle, we suffer, or my parents did. And then they gentrified, and then gentrification came on top of them. History is erased. And so this is one of the reasons why we become storytellers, is to tell the stories about the people who were there, even if all the physical traces of them are gone, except for the traces left in our memory, in our hearts, our feelings.
Yeah, I actually want to talk about this a little bit more later, because so much of your writing has to do precisely with this intersection of story and memory and identity and how those things kind of relate to each other. But before we move on, it occurs to me, listening to you talk about this experience, why it is that you don't want to be called an immigrant, right? Mm-hmm. You insist on being called a refugee. Mm-hmm. I call myself an immigrant. I mean, I'm not really a refugee. We didn't have refugee status. Yeah, we were running for our lives, but we never sort of saw ourselves in that way. But it's a pivotal, foundational part of who you are, isn't it?
Well, you know, I think a lot of people, who even those who are actually technically classified as refugees, don't want to be called refugees because it's a stigmatizing term, at least in the United States, right? And for me, I don't know if that ever really crossed my mind as I was growing up. Should I call myself an immigrant? Should I call myself a refugee? Is this a part of your life that, you know, that I lived through? But as I became a writer and I had to think about who I was writing about and find a very specific word to describe our experience, it couldn't be that we were immigrants.
Right.
You know, we didn't fit that classic immigrant story of taking your belongings and moving your family to a new country and hope with your hopes
Better
and aspirations.
Life. Yeah,
and
exactly, kind of right.
We were running for our lives, and we ended up actually being technically classified as refugees. And so the more I thought about it, the more I thought, I have to use this word. I have to use this term.
Claim it. Yeah.
And by claiming it, what's happening? I'm encouraging other refugees to acknowledge who they are, what they have been through, what their history is, and what their connection is to other people who are now arriving as refugees. Because there are a lot of former Vietnamese refugees who are like, well, we were the good refugees.
They're the bad ones.
These were the bad ones. Yeah. So don't
let
them
all the time. Yeah, you get that all the time.
You get all the time. And it's a very...
Well, you know, we came right. the right way.
Right. And it's a very American thing. Right, yeah. Stephen Miller, his ancestors were Jewish refugees
fuck
or immigrants.
That guy.
Or, yeah, fuck that yeah. guy. But there's a lot of them in the Trump administration, but there's a lot of them in America too, right? And so it's a very American thing. It's not just a Vietnamese thing.
Yeah,
but for me, it's a very Vietnamese thing because I know these Vietnamese refugees. I know them intimately. I grew up with them in San Jose of the 1970s and 1980s. And let me tell you something, there were a lot of bad Vietnamese refugees. We did a lot of terrible things. You know, we know how to break the law right. for our own benefit, okay? So that's a part of the American experience
yeah.
too. All that goes into my fiction, but into American storytelling. We don't just tell stories about how we're angels. You know, immigrants and refugees are not angels. We do some good stuff. We raise our families, but we also do some terrible things to each other
yeah.
as well. And that's a part of what we have
so
to say.
So at what point in this childhood, you know, this kind of the trials and the tribulations and the trauma and sort of surviving and making it and dealing with your sense of identity and this notion of what a refugee actually means and how that defines who you are and how you see the world, at what point did you say to yourself that, I want to be a writer? Like, how did that happen?
Well, like most writers, I was a lonely kid. And I was compounded, not just by the fact that I'm socially awkward or whatever, but also by being a refugee, becoming fluent in English, okay? Loving to read in English.
Tell me about that. Tell me how you got, because my experience of getting fluent in English was weird. All four of us, my mom, my dad, and my sister, were living in a one-room motel, mm-hmm. basically. And my parents told the manager, because they couldn't afford four people, they told the manager that they were the only two in the room. And so during the daylight hours, while the manager was on site, my sister and I weren't allowed to leave the room. At night, we'd go swimming and we'd hang out and stuff. But during the day, we'd stay in the room and watch nonstop TV, right. which I don't know what Vietnam was like, but there was no such thing as like 24-hour television mm-hmm. in Iran. I mean, we had TV. It was like three channels. It was mm-hmm. shit. It was like 6 hours a day.
Instead of Hogan's Heroes
it
and
was
Get
a,
Smart.
Yeah, there was like Chips.
All the great stuff. Yeah.
I mean, Chips was like mind-blowing to me. I mean, I was like, is this what it's like to drive on a highway mm-hmm. in California? Mm-hmm. Like cars just flip mm-hmm. over for no reason mm-hmm. all the time? Mm-hmm. Like, why are there ramps mm-hmm. everywhere? That cars just kind of, you know, like
that was a really 1980s thing, by the way. Cars flying off ramps.
Cars just flying off ramps happened all the time in the 80s. And it, 6 months. It took basically 6 months of television for me to be fluent. What was your experience like?
Well, you know, the interesting thing is I don't remember becoming fluent in English. I just remember from my earliest memories, probably when I was 5, 6, or 7, that I already could speak English. I went to kindergarten. I didn't have any problems as far as I can remember. And one of my earliest, fondest memories is the public library in Harrisburg, which my parents would take me to. Now, they only took me there for me, not for them, but I knew how to read.
Wow.
How did I learn? I don't have any memory of learning how to read. My parents didn't teach me.
Yeah.
It might have just happened. I might have had great teachers.
Yeah.
But by the time I got to San Jose, my parents are working 12 to 14 hour days every day of the week. My only recourse was to read and to go to the library. And so that that gave me a love of stories.
Tell me about those books. What were you reading?
Well, you know, I remember like reading Curious George, for example. And then I remember reading Tintin comics. I had early love for Tintin comics, which I'm passing on to my son, except for the fact that now I read Tintin
super
comics.
Super racist.
Like, they're kind of racist.
Super, super racist.
They go from being super explicitly racist to sort of liberal racism, to sort of gentle white man superiority
nice,
racism.
Exactly.
Okay. But they're still really good stories.
Yeah.
They're still really good stories. But the interesting thing, obviously, is this is a very common experience for those of us who are immigrants or refugees and become writers. The more we become writers and readers, the more we get separated from our parents who don't share the language.
That's right.
So it's a very painful experience at the same time that I couldn't share this love that I had with my parents. And so the love that I had for literature substituted for the love that I wasn't getting from mm-hmm. my parents. Of course, I was getting love from my parents. They were like feeding me, clothing me, sacrificing themselves for me.
Working their asses
but it wasn't
off.
The Brady
yeah.
Bunch.
Right.
Okay. So that was where I began to want to be a writer in the third grade. I wrote a book, drew the pictures, you know, wrote the words, bound the book, won a prize from the library.
What the fuck is... So every time you write something, they give you a prize?
In the third
is that
grade,
what happens?
They had good taste.
Fuck,
they
man.
Saw the talent early on. As a matter of fact, that epic was called Lester the Cat, about a really exhausted urban cat who flees to the countryside to find love.
That's a beautiful story.
Thank you.
I usually revive that.
It's available.
Okay. Do you remember the first time you actually broke the news to your parents
that I was going to be a writer?
That you wanted to be a writer?
Oh, God.
Or did you just not?
That was never officially stated.
Yeah, that's a smart move.
You're sort of just segue into it.
Yeah, yeah. It's like eventually they'll know.
Right. I mean, so for example, like, my brother, who became a doctor, of course, made my life better because he became the he's a great guy, but you know, so he became a doctor, and so that helped to clear the way for me. Like, maybe they didn't need two doctors. So he said to me when I went to college, just take pre-med, tell mom and dad you're going to be a doctor, but do whatever you want on the side. This is a classic Vietnamese way of dealing
absolutely.
With parental conflict.
Yeah,
you know, just fake them out. And so I did that for 11 weeks, and then I just gave up. I said, I can't even do pre-med. I can't even fake this. And I became an English major, but I told my parents, I'm going to become a lawyer. And so that held them off for 4 years.
That's a real job. Yeah.
And then when it came time to go to grad school, I said, okay, mom and dad, I'm going to become a doctor. And they said, really? And I said, a doctor of English. And they said, oh, okay, that's not quite what we were looking for. So my parents were actually relatively liberal in this regard. They said, okay, go get your doctorate, but you got to get a job. So that was always in the back of my mind. Got to get a job. So my dad was like, your brother finished his doctorate in 4 years. How long is it going to take you? I finished in 5. So when I got a job as a professor, that held them off.
Yeah.
But that was enough. Like, I wasn't going to tell them, on top of that, I really want to be a writer. Like, professor is just my day job.
Yeah, keep that on the DL. Exactly.
So I think the first time I ever told my parents was one of my stories, short stories, was translated into Vietnamese.
Wow.
And...
They read it in Vietnamese?
Well, so I went home and I gave it to my parents and I said, hey, this is actually in Vietnamese. Now you can actually read something I wrote. My parents are devout Catholics, super devout. This story was about a young Vietnamese refugee who comes to San Francisco in 1975 and discovers he's gay.
Whew.
They never mentioned that story to me again.
They just pretend the Vietnamese way.
Right.
Just pretend it doesn't happen. It's fine. Mm-hmm. I'm curious how much, you know, because I read The Sympathizer, I read, you know, the stories in refugees, and I wonder how much of these experiences that you have make their way into your stories. How much of it is autobiographical? I guess this is what I'm trying to say. Have you ever actually fucked a squid is what I'm trying to say here.
For people who
don't know what I'm talking about here, obviously the protagonist of The Sympathizer quite famously fucks a squid.
Right.
I'm not giving anything away. Did I just give away the ending?
It's not to everybody's taste. Apparently 1% of readers has absolutely refused. Judging from my Amazon.com and Goodreads reviews, they absolutely refuse.
Like, they got to the squid fucking and they were like,
yeah,
you know
no,
what?
This is not
that's
for me.
It. Yeah.
And I respect that. It's not for everybody's taste, obviously. But no, I have not literally, in the Clintonian sense, fucked a squid.
This story just got way better than I thought it was going to.
But my body parts have been inside a squid. Yes, I'll just leave it at that.
There's no way you're gonna leave it at that. Like, give me more.
So as a kid, I don't know if you ever read Philip Roth's Portnoy's Complaint.
Oh yes.
Okay. I read it as a precocious
kid.
And
by the way, I even recognized it as a Roth allusion.
Oh good.
So that's how much of a nerd I am.
Yes. We're brothers in that sense. But I remember reading Portnoy's Complaint, probably 12 or 13, and the only thing I remember for decades and decades was the moment when Portnoy, in that novel, he's 13 or 14, he's super horny, and he's masturbating with everything, including the slab of liver in his family refrigerator, which he masturbates into and then puts back into the fridge for dinner later that night. Okay, so that always stayed with me. But I didn't intend to actually put that into The Sympathizer. It just happened to be that I finished writing one day, and then I had to prepare dinner, and the menu was squid, which I had never cooked before. I did not know what you did with squid. But in order to make squid, you have to clean the squid. You have to put your fingers inside the squid. And at that point, I thought, wait a minute.
It's coming through now.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
This seems familiar. And then writers have to find the material wherever they can.
What are you going to do?
Wrote about it the next day.
What I love, by the way, the my favorite part about that story in The Sympathizer is that he then, like, cooks it and eats it. Like, I mean, who's going to, like, waste a perfectly good squid?
Well, he does it. He's very poor. His family is very poor. He only has his mother. His mother, this is a very special event for them to have squid. They're in a landlocked village. And so when his mother obviously has no idea what her son has done with the squid, and so she lovingly makes the stuffed squid, he voluntarily eats his own squid to prevent his mother from having to, obviously.
Now that is
do
a
this.
Good son.
Yes, a That's very good
a
son.
Very good son.
Very filial.
Let's move on. I want to talk about craft for a minute here. There's a lot. I mean, I love your writing. There's so much about it that I love. I love the fact that at the same time I can tell that you have an enormous amount of focus at the sentence level. Right. One of my sort of go-to lines about writing is that writing happens at the level of the sentence, right? Mm. Writing is putting sentences together. Mm. So if you can't command your sentences, you're not a writer. But what I love about your writing and your sentences is how effortless it looks, right? There's this kind of old saying that sometimes people use, I personally don't agree with it, but this notion that, you know, your sentences shouldn't draw attention to themselves, mm-hmm. right? Tell me about that. Tell me about the experience of sentence construction right. for you. What's that like?
Well, I mean, whether or not sentences draw attention to themselves is a very subjective matter, mm-hmm. right? You know, but basically when I wrote
the I like my sentences to shout. I want them to be like, fucking fireworks.
Okay, so basically, like, what I mean, the distinction would be between, like, Hemingway and Nabokov. Is it Nabokov? Right. Nabokov, I never had know how to say his name, but...
Depends on how cool you are.
Like, the acolytes of Hemingway, and there are a lot of them in the United States, you know, the whole generation of creative writing professors grew up reading Hemingway, for example.
I mean, every creative writing department is just basically teaching Hemingway, yeah.
And so it's a religion, no adjectives, you right. know, or whatever.
Yeah, no adverbs.
Yeah, and that worked in 1925, mm-hmm. but it's no longer 1925. It's not a universal condition, right? It's a style is a relative matter. And when I wrote The Sympathizer, I thought, I'm not Hemingway, obviously. And actually, you know, the style of my book, whatever the book is, has to express the character whoever's telling the story.
Absolutely.
Right?
Voice.
Yeah. And this narrator of The Sympathizer, as we would find out eventually, I didn't even know this when I was writing the book, but eventually I did. You know, he's writing under conditions of great duress. He's in a re-education camp writing a confession. And he's also a guy who's intensely literary as well. So I had to find the right voice for him. Mm. And the way I found the voice was, ironically, by reading another book. I was struggling to find the voice for The Sympathizer when I read a review in the LA Times of a new translation of a Portuguese novel that had come out in 1976 called The Land at the End of the World by Antonio Lobo Antunes.
But
you know him! I like
damn.
Him even better because 99% of Americans have 99.9% of people I mentioned have no idea who he is.
Genius,
right?
A Portuguese writer, a perennial right. Nobel right. Prize like right. runner up,
right?
Explanation of the birds changed right. my life.
If you mention his name in European literary circles, people at least know his name. In the United States, nobody has any idea who this
people
guy is.
People go out and read the works of Antonio Lobo Antunes.
Right, and he has a marvelous translator, at least for The Land at the End yeah. of the World, Margaret Ho Costa, who's a really brilliant translator of Spanish and Portuguese. So The Land at the End of the World is an autobiographical novel about a young Portuguese medic who gets drafted to go to the war in Angola, which is Portuguese, the Portugal's colony, and it's basically like their version of the Vietnam War. It's a horrible thing. But that's not the reason why I was attracted. The reason why was because the style of the novel is incredible. And it's a style that most Americans can't stand to read because it's not Hemingway. It's complete opposite.
Right.
It's dense, it's imagistic.
400-word sentences
right.
where you've like you've lost
right.
track of like where the sentence right. actually begins, and you don't care.
Right. And American readers have a fetish with like you should be able to pick up a book and read it in like 5 hours.
Right. Yeah.
Americans are lazy.
Beach reading.
Americans
Beach
are
reading,
lazy.
They say.
Right.
Yeah.
It's like a McDonald's version of literature, which is fine. It's fine. I love that too. But the fact that you can't do anything else is deeply problematic.
Right.
So for me, The Land at the End of the World was like drinking an espresso shot with every single page. Mm. You cannot do 300 espresso shots. I did 2 a day. But when I just was so energized by his prose. And so I thought that enabled me to write The Sympathizer in a way that I was aspiring to be like Lobo Antunes, which I failed in doing. But to me, his sentences were always very clear. It's just that they were so beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
I had to stop after like two or three.
Yeah, catch your breath.
Just to catch my breath, just to admire what he did with the images. That's what I wanted to do with the sympathizer. So there's clarity. And the other reason was I wanted to write sentences that I wanted to read. And I wanted the sentences to carry me from one sentence to the next, just with the rhythm of the prose, with the images, with the ideas in the sentence. Right, so when you read Lobo and Túnez, I just have to stop to admire the beauty of the images and the intellect that goes into making them. Now, that doesn't work for every book. It worked for the sympathizer, but that was the effort that I was trying to put into it. And I was looking for readers who would be like me. Now, there are a lot of readers who can't stand the sympathizer. It's fine, you know?
Yeah.
But there are readers who love the sympathizer. That's who I'm writing for.
The other thing that I really love about the way that you deal with craft is that you don't bullshit about the fact that writing is a grind. It's a grind, mm-hmm. you know? Like, it's a job. Mm-hmm. In fact, probably the thing that I say most to my students is that if you don't treat writing like a job, it'll never be your job, mm-hmm. right? I think so many young writers think that writing is an art, mm-hmm. right? There's a reason why we call it a craft, mm-hmm. right? So often I hear people say things like, I'm waiting for the spirit to move me, mm-hmm. you know, so that I can write. Mm-hmm. It's like, that's not how this works. Mm-hmm. Like, do you want to do this for a living? Mm-hmm. Then you have to treat it. There's no accountant who's like, I'm waiting for the spirit to move me before I can do your taxes.
Right.
You know, like, I need the muses, you know.
Here's a different way of thinking about it. Athletes. It's not like athletes just go out there and they play pro ball.
Yeah.
Like two hours out of the week.
Like it, they're like, I feel like this is the time.
Right. They're doing like 8 hours a day, sweating, grunting. It's not fun. I mean, it could be fun, but I mean, it's work.
It's work.
It's work in order to get to that beautiful moment when you can score that basket or whatever it is. And I think the same thing for writing, at least for me, you know, I really did, I think, put in 10,000 hours of very unglamorous sitting in a room trying to figure out how to write a sentence before I could get to the moment where I could write the sympathizer in 2 years, and almost every moment felt like joy. Except for the moment when I had to think about publishing the book, you know, but the actual moment of the art was amazing. But you sacrificed to get to that point.
Yeah. You know, speaking of the sympathizer, you refer to it as political satire. Mm-hmm. And I'd love for you to just kind of, you know, explain what you mean by that. Like, how do you understand it as a work of political satire, and how does it fit in sort of this kind of long tradition of satirical works, particularly works that have to do with war?
Yeah. Well, you know, there are satirists in American literature, right? And I don't like most of them because they're not very interesting, because they're not political. They're just, I read them like, it's sort of kind of funny, but things that are really funny are things that are political because they dig down deep into contradictions in ourselves or in our culture that we don't want to confront, right? And war is one of those contradictions. Americans think they're freedom-loving people, and yet we're going out there pretty much invading countries every single decade.
We're bringing them freedom, dude.
Right, yeah.
That's like how we do it.
Yeah, so it's our version of Newspeak. So how do you get at that? So one of the books that I always loved a lot was like Catch-22. Read it 3 or 4 times. Hilarious. And I thought, I could never write Catch-22. I'm not that funny. But I'm going to try, you know, because I think I'm going to write this very serious novel about some terrible things that happened in Vietnam involving Vietnamese and Americans and so on. And it's going to be 400 pages, and it's going to be really not a pleasant experience if it's all serious all the time. And I've read enough, you know, political satires like Catch-22 or Journey to the End of the Night by Louis Ferdinand Céline, which is another big influence from the early 20s in France. And I thought, these books are both very serious, but also very funny. Because what are they doing? They're taking up universal problems of absurdity and hypocrisy. You know, Americans are not unique in saying one thing and doing another. The French did it as well. Every country does it.
I know, but we perfected it.
We perfected it.
Like, we're just, it's like, that's what American exceptionalism is truly about.
One of the things that political satire does, though, is that it forces us to see things that we take for granted, that we think of as normal, and see them from the outside. So for Americans, it's normal that we live in a military-industrial complex, that we spend tons of money on, like, missiles. So it's normal that when we have a political problem in another country, we'll fire Tomahawk missiles into that country, each one of which costs more than the budget of the National Endowment for the Humanities or the Arts, whatever. That's stupid.
Yeah.
But we take it for granted. Political satire shows it to us.
Right.
Right. And I think for me as a refugee from Vietnam, I never felt completely American, even though my English is perfect. Right. I never felt completely American. So that helped made it easier for me to be a political satirist because I always was looking at things from the outside, even when Obama got elected. Okay. I was at Harvard when Obama had his inauguration. And it was like a holy event at Harvard.
Yeah.
Okay, I was in a room full of intellectuals.
White people?
Mostly, mm-hmm. Yes.
We were like, racism is over!
Right! They were so moved, and they were so patriotic. Everybody stood up at the national anthem or the whatever. And I was sitting at a table, and three of us didn't stand up. One guy was Mexican, one guy was German, and the other one was me.
Yeah.
You know, because I was like, I can sort of see where this is going.
Mm-hmm.
I'm thrilled we elected President Obama for all the obvious reasons, but I'm sort of kind of skeptical and suspicious about what's going to happen given what I know about American politics, right? And it sort of happened.
Or even more, even what you know about Vietnam. I say this all the time, you know, with this kind of the Trump years that we're in now, you know, one thing that you hear a lot from sober-minded people is that, well, this is just a blip, that America is permanent, that our political foundations will prevail, that it doesn't matter, you know, who's in the White House, that ultimately, you know, the pillars of our democracy are permanent. Have you ever heard an immigrant say that phrase? No. Like, you know, no immigrant ever says that phrase because we all know it changes like that.
Right, right. Do you have an escape hatch? I mean, do you have a plan?
Okay, I actually kind of do. I'm glad that you brought this up, but like my wife and I are preparing for what we just referred to sort of quietly as the zombie apocalypse. Mm-hmm. So we have our own chickens now in our own garden. We have our own bees. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're ready. We're ready to go.
I think that's, I don't know if that's an immigrant mentality, but it's certainly a refugee mentality. Yeah. Like you saw your country go to shit. You don't take nothing for granted. You know, you know power can be abused. And countries are not unique. Every country has a high-minded set of ideals, and every country has the potential to betray them because every country is built on a contradiction. Okay, so, you know, the fact that Trump is now our president was shocking to a lot of people and shocking to me, but in one way, but not a surprise in another way, because how do we go from Obama in one cycle to Trump in another? Trump didn't come out of nowhere. He came out of the American sewer or whatever you want to call it, you know. So these two representatives represent two aspects of the American contradiction, and they are not going away. Right. And so optimistically, we work to change our society. But pessimistically, I have an escape hatch. I hope I have one.
Tell me about your escape hatch just so we can, just in case. We don't live that far from each other. I want to make sure. Do I need to come to your house?
So it's kind of ironic that my escape hatch cannot be Vietnam. My books are banned in Vietnam.
No kidding.
Or censored anyway. Oh, wow. Like soft banning. Okay. So I was talking to Walter Mosley last night, and he was like, oh yeah, my book's available in Vietnamese. And I saw Colson Whitehead, who won the Pulitzer, his book got translated into Vietnamese. And I'm like, my book is not translated into Vietnamese because the government won't allow it to be published. Yeah. I'm actually okay with the Vietnamese pirating my works, because that's what I always expected. You know, I thought it would be a badge of honor to be pirated in Vietnam, but that's better than getting censored.
Okay? Right.
So basically, I can't go back to Vietnam, right? So where can I go? Well, I've spent a few summers in France now. I'm taking adult French classes. My six-year-old boy is in a French school. So my escape hatch is to go back to my other colonizer.
Right, exactly, yeah.
So this is how history fucks us, you know, because like France has a lot of its own problems, but the Vietnamese got it good in France, you know, because of very particular historical colonial conditions. And the French like to think they're better than the Americans. Right? So they're perfectly, I'm hoping, happy to take a refugee from the United States.
We'll see about that.
Yeah.
Hey there, everyone. It's Reza. I'm sorry for the interruption. I just wanted to pop in and say that if you're enjoying this episode, well, then you're in luck, my friends, because Rough Draft is also a TV show, and you can watch it all right now, along with topics, other original series, and exclusive programming from around the world. You can check it out for free on the Apple TV app, which is already on your favorite devices. With Apple TV, you can watch Topic at home or on the go with offline viewing,
And you can even share your subscription with up to 6 family members with family sharing, which is what I do because I have a gigantic family. Go to apple.co/topic to start your 7-day free trial now. That's apple.co/topic.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
In your book, Nothing Ever Dies, which is basically like an extended, essay, you say something that just, I think, really caught my attention. You say, all wars are fought twice, the first time on the battlefield, and the second time in memory.
I am so proud of that sentence, by the way.
It's a good sentence. Yes. It's a good, you worked on that for a while, right? Is that how you understand stories? Is that what the function of stories are, to kind of maintain this link to the past? Is it part of our memory, in fact? I guess what I'm trying to say is, do you see yourself as a storyteller, as somebody who's doing more than just providing, a narrative, but somebody who is truly kind of linking the past to the present?
Well, yeah, and it goes to this idea or fantasy I have of myself as being a political writer, mm-hmm. And to be a political writer in the United States is kind of rare, I think, because, in the United States, Americans on the average are sort of hostile to the idea of politics in their arts. They associate that with communism or socialism, and God, that's terrible to have in the United States. But for me, I was always drawn to literature that was obviously about great stories, but about great stories that were connected to real social issues. This was the only way I could justify to myself my love for literature. Because I would read a book, I'd have a great time, and then I'd have to go outside of my bedroom, and my parents were there. It's like, I couldn't be an art for art's sake kind of person with parents who were working 12 to 14 hours a day and getting shot in their store, okay? So for me, it was crucial.
It had to matter.
It had to matter.
Yeah.
And then I was growing up in a Vietnamese refugee community for whom the war had never ended. And I was growing up in the 70s and 80s in America, and the war had never ended, the Vietnam War. If you went to the movie, the cinemaplexes, what were you watching? You were watching Apocalypse Now, you're watching Platoon, you're watching Rambo. Americans were still fighting their wars 10 to 15 years later, and in fact, they're still fighting the war now because Michael Mann is making a movie about the Battle of Hue. Spike Lee is making a movie about Vietnam.
We can't let it go.
So from my own personal experience, this is totally true. We fight the war. The war takes 5 or 10 years, now it's taking 20 years or more, but regardless, we will keep fighting this war in the aftermath as we try to make sense of it. Now, this is really crucial because I, as a professional storyteller, you as a professional storyteller, we know the importance of stories, we write stories, but in fact, for everybody, stories matter. Yeah. Trump is a great storyteller. I hate his story, but he's got a good one because he seduced a whole bunch of people with it.
Yeah.
And the stories we tell about war are a part of that. His basic story is, we good, they bad, okay? So that's his diction.
The oldest story.
That's his diction, right? And that's how we mobilize people to fight wars, and that's how we mobilize people to stand up and pledge allegiance and all that other kind of stuff. So this is how we fight wars over and over again. So I feel like my purpose as a storyteller is to try to make an intervention there.
Right. But I wonder, I don't want to mangle a metaphor here, but are we bringing a pen to a knife fight? I feel like, you look at sort of sentiment in the United States about refugees, particularly in those groups like white evangelicals, for whom, it's kind of a commandment to actually care for the widow and the orphan and the suffering. And yet, 7 out of 10. White evangelicals, who, by the way, make up 100 million of us, say that we should close our doors to all refugees. And I don't know, maybe it's the booze, maybe I'm just feeling pessimistic, but How does a storyteller combat that? Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I wrestle with that probably literally every day in my life, you know, because I love stories. I love literature. I love art. I think these things really matter, and they do, all right? And we need people to do these things because they sustain us as a culture. But certainly for those of us who are actually practitioners and those of us who love the arts, we need them, okay? And then we have to balance that with this other reality that you're talking about, which is these other people who are determining policies that are devastating lives, whether it's, refugee policy or these concentration camps on the borders and so on and so on. I mean, when you're faced with that reality as a writer, an artist, storyteller, whatever, I think it's perfectly logical to have this feeling, well, what I do doesn't matter. I need to go out there on the streets, I need to organize, and so on and so forth. And we do, but for those of us who really believe in the arts, we're torn. Yeah. And my personal feeling for this is I'm a pretty good writer. I can make a difference there more than I could if I was devoting my life only to organizing or to activism or politics. Yeah. People keep telling me, oh, maybe you should run for office.
Why do people do that all the time?
Well, because I look good in a suit. Yeah. And
you
I can make a
damn
speech.
Fine in a suit,
yeah,
by the way.
I objectively look good in a suit, okay? And I can give a good speech and I can say the right things. So in a really fucked up world, I can become a politician. I don't want to do that.
Yeah.
Okay. So we all make our own choices and we all make our own compromises. All those people who are politicians, they think they're making a difference, and look at the Republican Party. But fuck, they're not doing anything. They're elected, they have power, and they're not doing anything. Mm-hmm. So it's a relative situation. Yes, the people who have the levers of power can do more than a novelist or a poet. But for those of us who are novelists and poets and storytellers, we have our eye on other pressing human issues. And in the future, people aren't going to remember 99.9% of politicians. They're not going to remember 99.9% of artists either, frankly.
But the
stories will survive. And the ones that survive, people will remember that 100
the
years
that
from now.
They're the ones that will transform. Yeah.
And so it's cold comfort to the people who are in concentration camps or the people who can't get into this country. And I can't do anything about that. But I have to believe that the stories still matter. The stories can make a difference. Yes, we have these people who are not following the Bible, and it's like, oh, let's not help the stranger and the refugee and the foreigner and so on. But we can also point at other circumstances where, in fact, I mean, the American consciousness has moved for a certain percentage of people. Things are not the same as they were in the 1950s or 1960s, which is not to deny the terrible things that are happening now, but it's to acknowledge that, in fact, our story has changed, that there are more people who believe in different kinds of stories. There are more white people who recognize that whiteness is a problematic thing. Mm. This would not have existed 50 or 60 years ago to the same degree that it does now. And it has changed because of political activism, but it has also changed because of storytellers.
Yeah. There's one thing that I heard about you a while ago, and I'm not sure if this is true, so I'm going to just ask you this. I heard that you are quite adamant about the fact that you're not writing for a white audience. Which, by the way, I'm sure, like, just please the shit out of your publisher. Yeah. You're like, this isn't for white people. It's fine. But that your sort of the imaginary audience that you envision, that all writers have kind of in the back of their minds, like, who are you writing for? That in your case, you actually think that that audience is Vietnamese.
Well, no, it's worse than that. The audience is me. The one Vietnamese right? person, me. Yeah. No, I'm serious. When I wrote The Sympathizer, I mean, the way I wrote it was to say, I'm writing it for me. Because if I wrote it for Vietnamese people, it would actually be a very different book. Mm. Because Vietnamese people don't necessarily have good literary taste. Okay. And Vietnamese people, like every other people, a lot of people want the stories to flatter them in some way. They want the stories to affirm their own worldview in some way. So I'm Vietnamese, yes, and I want to speak to Vietnamese people and I want to tell Vietnamese stories, but I recognize that I don't agree with a lot of Vietnamese people. Like, a lot of Vietnamese Americans will not read The Sympathizer because it's written from the perspective of a communist spy.
Right.
And they're like, we don't want anything to deal with communism. But That's not my problem. Okay, my problem, my challenge is to write a story that I care about and to write it in a way that other Vietnamese people who are willing to read the book will care about too. So my next audience is Vietnamese people. And I think this is very important. And, you know, Toni Morrison died not long ago, and one of the greatest lessons that Toni Morrison has left for us who are writers is her utter, absolute conviction that you can write for your own people, whoever that is, and let everybody else come along. Hmm. That you don't have to write to the people in power, you don't have to write to the majority, you don't have to write to white people, however you define the people in power, you don't have to write to them. It's a greater challenge maybe to write for your own population, especially if they're not in power, however you define that. But truth, beauty, universality comes out of that.
That's beautiful, yeah.
You know? And when people come up to me, Vietnamese people, for example, and they're crying, it happens sometimes, and we never heard our story, or I didn't ever want to think about this issue, and now you have talked about it. That is enormously important to me, because I didn't have that opportunity when I was growing up. I was reading Tintin, okay? I didn't have that opportunity.
Right.
And so this is where storytelling can make a difference, because hopefully now, you know, there's going to be a whole nother generation of Vietnamese-American storytellers, and they're going to write a whole bunch of stories that I have no understanding of. And that's good.
Right.
That's good. I'm dealing with my own issues. I'm dealing with my past, my trauma, my war. I don't expect the next generation to deal with this kind of stuff. I want them to be able to deal with something else because I dealt with this. And I was able to clear some issues out of the way so they can go off and do something radically different.
You had said earlier that the work is banned in Vietnam, but have you been back to Vietnam? I mean, have you heard from anyone in Vietnam who has read the book? I mean, has there been any response that you can track?
Oh, the last time I was in Vietnam was 2014, and then the novel came out in 2015, The Sympathizer, and I haven't been back because I would like an invitation from the Vietnamese government to say, hey, we're not going to like turn you back at the border or detain you in some way. But the interesting thing is that I've in my travels throughout the United States to college campuses, for example, I've met quite a few Vietnamese foreign students who come to my events. They're obviously enthusiastic, although otherwise they wouldn't come. And for them, they tell me everybody is reading your book in Vietnam. And so it's obviously a relative term. But in other words, there is a population in Vietnam that has been able to find the book in English. They're obviously of a certain class or background to be able to read it in English. And for them, what I'm being told is, this story is not available. This kind of story that I'm telling has not been told in Vietnam because the only version of the past is a state-sponsored version, which is even more problematic than the American version of the past. So there's a hunger for a different, hopefully more truthful, or at least more complex version of the past in Vietnam that The Sympathizer is helping to fulfill.
So this is fascinating to me. So not that long ago, I saw this really fascinating short documentary called Nobody Dies. I don't know if you've seen it, but it's a documentary in which an amazing musician named Tao Nguyen from Tao and the Get Down, Stay Down goes back with her mom to Vietnam. She does a performance there, and it's sort of this amazing experience about that notion of going back, like what it means to sort of connect as an artist to roots that you may or may not actually have any deep connection to, and here's the good news, she's actually here.
Really?
That's right.
Amazing.
So, without further ado, let's bring up Tao Nguyen.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, come on, Tao.
All right.
Woo! Tao, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
As I kind of mentioned a little bit earlier, I've been obsessed with you for a long time. I know Viet's been obsessed with you for a long time. You know, I saw this documentary that you made in which you and your band went back to Vietnam with your mom, and I don't know. It moved me so much. I think it's probably because I also have like a kind of, a foreign mom. And so I know what that experience is like. But I wanted you to kind of join this conversation because, first and foremost, I know you were born in the States, but, you come from immigrant parents.
Refugee parents.
Refugee parents. That's right.
Yeah.
How much of this sort of conversation that we've been having, how much of it rings true to you?
I mean, it rings so true. I don't know if I hope that my just like tears welling up in my eyes are showing up on camera, but so much of it. I and you know, I have to credit Viet, and I'm sure he hears this all the time. I know he does. But his writing has helped open discussions, external discussions and just internal discussions around identity, around place. And I grew up in Virginia. And there was such an emphasis on assimilation, and there was such a silence, this just diligent, industrious silence that that you just become really accustomed to. And you may never develop any facility for language around that. And I really think Viet's work has helped so many people like myself engage, sort of try to talk to our families more, understand what we're doing and what kind of shortchanging has taken place.
I'm curious, what did assimilation mean to you back then? Like, what did you understand it to mean?
It meant that you had, it meant that you were obviously different, but had to act as same as possible and deny. I mean, and I'll say that how I internalized it was I was an active participant in denying my heritage.
Right.
You know, and that it's so easy to do. And
you want to fit in. You want to be like everybody else.
Yeah. You don't even. I mean, I didn't even hang out with other Vietnamese kids. There were a few. I didn't hang out with them. And it, you know, it bleeds in. If you allow it, it's very pervasive, and it'll bleed in well into your adulthood. I think that it was hard because when you're, you know, I still grew up in a house that was very proud to be Vietnamese, but at the same time, I would see this deference once everyone left the house, and I would see the way my parents were treated. Because I was born in Virginia, the nuances of language, the nuances of condescension and racism that they wouldn't even know to pick up on.
You
absorb all of it.
Right. You knew it was happening.
That drove me crazy. You know, to see, because you know, if you're Vietnamese, you're living in a Vietnamese community or Vietnamese household, we're not deferential to each other.
Right.
But then,
totally.
then they step out of their own community.
Yeah.
And then they have to defer.
Yeah, yeah.
And to white people.
Yeah.
For good reason, but it's still so. I felt it was like demeaning on some level.
It has such an impact. And I would see my dad say, "It's just sir, everyone."
Sir, everyone. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But we can get into this later. But the ideas of what happens to a Vietnamese man in a society that's not accepting of him in a sort of an emasculating society, how he brings that home, is really particular.
Right, where he can actually make himself feel like the man that he's supposed to be at home, that he doesn't get to be outside.
Right. Yeah.
Is that what drew you to music?
Similar to what you were saying, utter loneliness.
Man, loneliness is a really good drug.
I mean, if I could bottle that.
You couldn't sell it to anybody, though.
That's right. I know. I'd have to frame it in a songwriting workshop.
Yeah.
Loneliness, it was a really turbulent home that I grew up in. Mm. And so it was something that I could do in, you know, alone. And it was definitely a form of escape.
Mm. I wonder if, like, as your experience as a songwriter, how much of that taps into these emotions that are obviously so raw for you. I mean, like, that's the thing about your music is, like, and your performances, you know, I mean, what everybody says when they see you is it's such an experience to see you and to hear you sing. I mean, there's the emotion is so obvious. What are you tapping into? Or is this where it comes from?
Thanks for saying that. I think it's a dysfunction. I think it's because I haven't figured out enough of my shit. And I am, like, pretty intermittently going to therapy, and I can never just consistently go. And because of my touring schedule, I can always blame touring. But it's a time capsule. It's like sort of embedded in this amber, and it can't get out. And I don't know. I've been doing this for a long time now, like maybe 13, 14 years, and it won't go anywhere. And it feels like I have this like inexhaustible well of rage or sadness or whatever it is. There's pain there. I don't think it's healthy. I would, I would love to figure it out.
But it comes out on stage.
It does, yeah.
Yeah. So yeah. Maybe that's your therapy.
Yeah. Thanks. Yeah. Well, that's cheaper, so that's nice. Yeah.
You actually get paid for it instead of actually having to pay other people. I'm curious, what's been the response of your family to this path that you carved for yourself? You know, we've talked about like having to negotiate, immigrant parents basically lie. I mean, lie. I think that's the best way to put it. Is that something that you experience as well?
Oh, yeah, I've definitely lied. But my mom has been incredibly supportive.
Your mom is awesome.
She's such a gem. Yeah. If you all see her in this documentary that only, I think, like four people have seen. I'll send it to you. And then my mom maybe has seen it. She's incredible. And, I'm so, and it's similar to Vute's parents, that kind of sacrifice. She ran a laundromat. So I grew up working in a laundromat in Virginia. And there was a wash, dry, and fold service, and there was also machine washers, and there was dry cleaning. And she worked, it's the typical work week, which is about 1 million.
90 hours,
And I always, and my brother and I always served as the translators growing up, and there was always this tension. And, and I was such an asshole because I always was I was embarrassed by her English, and I never wanted her to come to parent-teacher conferences. Mm-hmm. It took a long time until I realized, I couldn't go to another country and do shit. What could I do?
I can barely speak English.
That's true. Right.
I'm
like, I can barely get in the lift. I don't know. But it was so amazing to see her in Vietnam, even though it was so intense for her to come, to go back. I had never been, and this was her first time back in 43 years. And she had worked for the South Vietnamese embassy when she was in Vietnam. And actually, at the fall of Saigon, she was stationed in Laos. So she fled from Laos because she was tipped off that the communist government was coming in to look for South Vietnamese representatives. And it took 17 tries to get her to come. But then to see her there and the way there was just this dimension of her that I had never seen before. And it was so beautiful. And it was, she's, joking around. She's leading us. We have no idea where we're going. I can speak Vietnamese, but I can't read anything. Or it'd take me about 5 hours to figure out what the accent, like what the tone is. I don't. And to see her negotiating, just haggling and ordering at the restaurant, just all these simple things that we never got to experience in the U.S. with her.
She was in her own element.
She was in her own element. It was remarkable. And I don't think she'll go again. I think that was enough for her. And
by the way, I just want to say, I love the fact that all three of us, like later in life, have realized what superheroes our parents actually were. Mm-hmm. I think that's a very common experience. Mm-hmm. You know, I was thinking, one of my favorite parts of The Sympathizer is there's this moment where the protagonist has this liberal arts college professor, like a douchey kind of guy, who reads him this Kipling line, right? This famous Kipling line that we've all read at some point in our, high school English literature classes. East is east, west is west, and
never the twain shall meet.
Never the twain shall meet, right? Which is such utter bullshit, right? I mean, it's like, well, then what am I? Like, what? I am the East and the West meeting. So what the fuck are you talking about, Rudyard Kipling? But the professor has the protagonist do something really bizarre, which I just love. He has him take a piece of paper mm-hmm. and fold it in half. Mm-hmm. And on one side, he writes Orient. And on one side, he writes Occident. And he basically says, I want you to kind of dissect your personality and categorize it. Like, what part of you comes from the Orient and what part of you comes from the Occident? And the whole point of this is to show the sort of the dichotomy, right? Mm-hmm. The conflict between the two. So people don't know this, but before we came on this taping, I asked you guys to do that very same thing. I did it too. Mm-hmm. Take a piece of paper, write Orient on one side, Occident on the other, and then basically analyze yourself according to those totally constructed categories. I did it. You guys did it. You did it. Let's share it with
All
everyone,
right.
shall we?
Okay.
All right. I got mine right here. Okay, I'll go first.
You go first.
I'll break the seal. I'll go first. So I'm going to say, these are the things about me that come from the Orient, mm-hmm. and these are the things about me that come from the Occident. Okay, so, all right. Orient, my refusal to talk about money. You know what I mean? Like, I don't want to talk about money. I just don't want to have any conversation that involves money at all. My wife negotiates everything. I will literally pay a person anything that they ask just so I don't have to talk about money. Occident, my inability to think about anything except money. It's all I think about. Orient. This thing that I have where I'm just convinced that everything is my fault. Do you know what I mean? Like, just whatever it is, it's my fault. I'm sure it is my fault. Occident, the refusal to apologize for anything. You know what I mean? Like, why would I say I'm sorry? I'm American. I'm not sorry for anything. Orient, I don't know if this is true for you guys. This might just be a Middle Eastern thing. But I am superstitious as fuck. Like, I am the most superstitious person. I knock on wood for any reason at all. Like, I'll never say anything good out loud. Because if you say it out loud, you know, some, like, the spirits will hear. Occident, my utter certainty that nothing bad will ever happen to me, ever. That I will live forever. Orient. Sort of this, like, anxiety that I have that unless I have at minimum 4 jobs, that I'm doing it wrong. Do you know what I mean? Like, I got at least 4 jobs. Mm-hmm. Minimum 4 jobs. Occident. How many Netflix episodes can I binge if I don't leave my house for a week? Mm-hmm. Like, that's my Occidental thought. And then finally, Orient. And talking about moms, this is a mom thing that I think you guys will appreciate. Orient, this kind of weight, this burden that I carry, which is like all about whether my mother is actually happy, which is impossible, yeah. by the way. Nothing would make my mother happy ever. But like this constant burden that it's like my responsibility to make sure that she's happy. Occident. How quickly can I put her in an old folks home? Like, that's like, is that a thing that I can do? Because apparently, like, that's a thing. Like, Americans do that. They just shovel off old people into homes. Anyway, that's mine.
Well, I have one question about the money thing. Because with money, it seems to me like Vietnamese people want to talk about money all the time.
Oh, really? Okay, yeah, that's definitely a Middle Eastern thing. Like, okay.
We have different, like, kinds of Orientals here. Right. Yeah. When I go to Vietnam, like, people always say, "What? How much money do you make? Or how much does that cost?" I'm like, "What? Should I tell the truth? Should I lie?"
Especially Persians, we have this thing where like we like to pretend that money doesn't matter. We have this for people who don't know, this like cultural thing called taaruf, which is basically like, yeah, there's a groan in the audience from somebody who's experienced taaruf. Yeah, it's best understood as insincere deference, but it's like. This thing that Persians do all the time where, like, they'll insist on, you know, paying for everything. Or if, like, don't, for God's sakes, never, ever sort of praise a Persian for something that they're wearing. You know, don't ever be like, well, that's a nice watch. Because you know what a Persian will say? This watch?
That's a really
it's
nice
your,
watch.
It's your. This is your.
That's a really nice
this is,
watch.
This is my. This is your watch. Is I can't. Okay, I can't right, even. Cool.
This is a nice show. Watch back.
The American side kicks in.
I like yours. This is a nice show.
Yeah.
You got a nice show.
One
here.
Vietnamese
nice
way that's similar is that Vietnamese people will always invite you over. Oh, it's been so great seeing you. Come over anytime.
But they don't mean it.
They don't mean
they
it.
Don't
God
mean
forbid
it
you
all.
Actually accept the. I've never accepted the invitation. But they will always say, "Come on over."
All right. Let's see. Let's hear your Orient and Occident.
All right. And by the way, I have to say that this is actually not my idea. I had read the writer Frank Chin, and I can't remember where I read this, but he said, and he was a student at Berkeley in the 60s, and he went to the Iowa writers program like you did. But he, as an undergraduate, he said this is what one of his teachers made him do, divide himself, you know, put a line down, East and West, or Orient and Occident,
an
and write down, yeah, and write down his two opposing characteristics. Okay, Oriental. I make my son play classical piano.
Of course you do.
He's 6 years old.
Yeah, okay. He's, yeah.
Occidental. I let my son watch videos on an iPad.
Okay. Right.
Oriental. I know how to use chopsticks. Occidental. I prefer to use a fork.
I mean, who doesn't? It's
right.
So much easier.
It's actually shocking, but it's true. Oriental. I wash my plastic sandwich bags and reuse them.
I got to come up with another.
Yeah. Like, we are the original green people. Yeah. We don't waste anything. Occidental. I throw away my plastic bags. Okay. Oriental. I usually take off my shoes when I enter my house. Occidental. Sometimes I'm lazy and I wear my shoes into my house.
Does like your you go mom out know? Of the. I mean,
it's like you go into the garage and you forget something. And you have lace-up shoes. What are you going to take off your shoes just to go back into the house to get your iPhone or your keys or whatever it is? No,
once I wore my shoes in the house, and my mom said, "Are you an animal?" And I was like, "But animals don't wear shoes." But all right, I get it.
Mm-hmm. All right,
all right, Tal, it's yours.
Okay. Well, I might prove your point that it's hard to do this and almost. Unrealistic to ask someone to do this because I tried to correlate them. As you can see, it's scattered. The one good one I had was plastic bag. Okay, from the Orient, my mind being blown when I learned that people let their cats sleep on their pillows.
Ew.
Right?
Ew.
I don't have like an Occidental side. Of
Occidental, there's no Occidental side. Yeah.
I've seen a cat video. Okay. Let's see. Packing from the Orient. Packing food wherever I go, and refusing to buy food out. And then Occidental is like sometimes In-N-Out Burger is pretty good. And I love French fries, so I'm gonna buy those because it's really such a pain in the ass to deep fry stuff at home.
So yeah.
So I'm not gonna do that. When I this is a joke. I'm an incredible driver. And then I had this is Occidental. Now we're going. I'm sorry, it's scattered.
No,
the Occidental. I now put dry goods in mason jars. But when I was young, I would go to a white person house, and I would look, and it was a sleepover or something, and I would be. There, we'd have in the morning there would be cereal, and then I would be like, I don't know where are all the cereal boxes, and they all had been emptied from the boxes into Tupperware.
Into jars.
That's
so, yeah.
True.
And
I do that now too.
Keeps
right?
In the trash.
Before,
I do that too, but I also have like an extremely white wife.
Yeah.
like translucently white.
Yeah. Me too. Okay, and then. Okay. I don't know how many we're on, but I have just a couple more. When I was in school, I studied sociology, and I had this, I've developed this like immediate affinity for Edward Said and Orientalism, those ideas. Occidental side, I always want to pronounce it Edward Said. Okay, that's all.
That was a good one.
Thanks.
That was actually when I first encountered Edward Said in college. That was my reaction.
Right?
Edward Said? What is that?
I've never heard of
that.
What is that? I don't know.
Well, part of the treat of having you here, Tao, is that we get to actually hear you perform. You're going to play a song called Age of Ice?
I am. Yes.
All right. We'd love to hear it. Everybody, Tao Wen.
All right. Woo!
From the age of ice, I suppose I would survive. I remember you with a feeling or two, free of hands without device. Slowly we all lay down. Slowly. Stone I invented to coat my hands and face. I was made of machine and gasoline, filled a full on just a taste. No, no, I wasn't born to break such bounds. I suppose I would survive.
That was awesome.
That was amazing.
Amazing.
Good choice for a musical guest.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, when you asked me, do you have any ideas for a musical guest? And my first thought was Tao. And then you said Tao. And I was like,
such synergy.
Yeah.
Okay, so one of the traditions of Rough Draft is we do this thing that we call five questions. Mm-hmm. Okay, so this is kind of a rapid fire thing. Mm-hmm. All right, you don't have to think about it too much, but you know, feel free to answer as you will. All right, here we go. Number one, what's your favorite book?
That's a really hard question. It's an impossible question, but my favorite recent book is Paul Beatty's The Sellout,
I don't know it.
You don't know Paul Bailey's a sellout?
No,
I am so disappointed in you.
Down,
oh
man.
My God, it won the Booker Prize. I think he was like the first American to win the Booker Prize.
Right.
And Paul and I have met a couple of times and had long conversations. I think we are so simpatico. And when I read the sellout, I knew why, because a sellout is a satire about contemporary America, set in Los Angeles, about a black guy who owns a slave. You know, so it's completely ludicrous and completely hilarious. And so, yeah, read it. You'll love
but
it.
But no squid fucking.
I have outdone Paul in that regard.
Okay, you win that. Yeah. Number two, what's your writing process? Tell us about your writing process.
I mean, ideally, my writing process in The Sympathizer is to get up right in the morning, go have lunch with squid, for example, and then go run for an hour. And that's part of the where the creative juices come from. Now I have a son. Life is much more complicated, but still try to get 3 to 4 hours of writing done a day.
So you go by hours, not word count.
Whatever makes me feel better on a given day.
You know, I've never understood people who do word count. Because, like, if your goal is 350 words, I can write 350 words.
Well, the thing is,
it's shit.
Yeah. It's shit. But you process the shit. I don't know how this metaphor works, but, you know, it gets better.
Yeah.
So, I mean, the idea of the word count only works for a certain amount. You got to get the words out, and then you revise. So I don't know how you count the revisions, but 3 or 4 hours seems to work.
Yeah.
I just interviewed Walter Mosley yesterday. The dude has 57 books. His writing process, he says, 3 hours a day, 360 days a year. That leads to 2 or 3 books a year.
I don't even know what that's like. Number three, if you weren't a writer, what would you be?
Well, I am a professor. I guess that's my other day job.
Yeah.
And if I wasn't a professor, I'd be a lawyer. And if I wasn't a lawyer, I'd be a priest.
All of which would make your mom very happy.
The priest would have been best.
What's the worst writing advice you've ever gotten?
When we were shopping The Sympathizer, there was a very famous editor who could give 6-figure advances, and he had an hour-long conversation with me. And one of his major suggestions with The Sympathizer was that he felt that my narrator needed to have a relationship with somebody. And
A love story. He was like, I need a love story.
That was the implication, because he had edited another book that won the Pulitzer Prize that was kind of similar to mine that featured a love story. And I thought, that's not... I was like, he asked me, who do you think your narrator is having a relationship with? And I thought, himself. That's not the right answer to give.
Yeah.
And so I didn't take his advice. He didn't buy my book. And the shocking thing, as I found out later, was that he could give 7-figure advances, because his last act as an editor was to give a new writer $1 million advance.
And then he got fired.
No, he quit.
And last but not least, what's the best writing advice that you can give to a young writer or struggling writer or emerging writer, somebody who's getting their career off the ground?
Eventually, what I think every writer needs to be able to do is to be able to write just for themselves. Mm. It's actually kind of hard to do that. When you're a kid, you can do that. You don't care. Then you're an adult. You can start to worry about your rent, your prestige. Can you sell the book, et cetera? You start to worry about what other people think about your book or your story. Finally, being able to write for yourself is being able to write authentically and honestly, courageously. It's really hard to do. Every writer needs to be able to get to that point.
Be a ton of win, everyone.
Thanks, Reza. Thank you so much.
Okay, so Viet and Tao are gonna switch seats, and I'm gonna do that whole thing over again. Okay, Tao, 5 questions. You ready?
Yes.
What is your favorite book?
Marilynne Robinson's Gilead.
Oh, yeah.
It's a good one.
Powerful, powerful book.
Yeah.
Tell us about your writing process. How do you write a song? Like, what's that? What's involved in putting a song together for you?
Find out what the deadline is.
Right? Step one.
Wait. And then freak the fuck out.
Yeah, procrastinate, then, freak out.
Procrastinate. Uh-huh. I love looking. There's a book, a most recent collection of writer's routines. I actually love reading about writer's routines and then trying to, every day, just assume a different writer identity. And I'm like, oh, well, Murakami wakes up at 4 and runs 7 miles.
That's what I'm going to do.
So I just think about doing it. I don't do it. But recently, similar to Viet, that I try to work 3 or 4 hours a day in the morning, because I've found that past noon, it's not happening.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If you weren't a songwriter, what would you be?
I wanted to be a writer when I was a kid. I would be a short story writer. And then I would supplement that with growing my own produce and catering small dinners.
Wow, that's super specific.
Thank you. I've been thinking about it because I'm really tired of touring. So.
What's the worst writing advice that you've ever gotten?
Read this book about songwriting.
A book about songwriting? Yeah. I can't even imagine what that would be like.
I can't either because
Is it just like a rhyming dictionary?
It was like something out of, it's something out of Barnes & Noble, or it's, you know, industry buzzwords or something.
And what's the best advice that you can give to a songwriter who's just kind of starting out?
Trust that you have good ideas. And then once you get to a point where, if you're lucky enough for people to pay to see you, remember that they pay to see you.
That's very good.
Thanks.
Tawin, everyone. Thank you so much to my guests on this episode of Rough Draft, Viet Thanh Nguyen. You could, of course, follow him on his socials. That's at Viet, V-I-E-T, underscore T, underscore Nguyen, N-G-U-Y-E-N. Thank you also to our special musical guest, Tao Wen. You can follow her at Tao Get Stay Down. That's at T-H-A-O Get Stay Down. And of course, you can listen to Tao and the Get Down, Stay Down on Apple Music or Spotify or wherever you get your music. Rough Draft is a Topic original series hosted by me, Reza Aslan. Executive produced by Reza Aslan, David Andreoni, Alfredo De Villa, and Safa Samizadeh Yazd. Executive producers for Topic are Ryan Chametry, Anna Holmes, and Gina Constantinakos, with production aid from Russell Sperberg. Our music and theme is by Jacob Snyder, sound by Sean Oakley, editing and mixing by Will Stanton, with additional editing by Blake V. You can follow Rough Draft on Twitter at Rough Draft Reza, on Facebook at Rough Draft with Reza Aslan, or you can email us at roughdraftpodcast@topic.com. You can also follow me, Reza Aslan, at Reza Aslan. For transcripts and a list of full credits, go to topic.com/rdpodcast. If you love this interview, be sure to check out our TV show, as well as Topic's original series and exclusive programming from around the world. Try it for free on the Apple TV app, already on your favorite devices. You can watch Topic at home or on the go with offline viewing, and you can also share your subscription between up to 6 family members with family sharing. That's what I do. Go to apple.com/topic to start your 7-day free trial now. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time on Rough Draft.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.